The book of Job cultivates admiration for Job, but Job questions divine justice. Is the book of Job trying to cultivate an admiration of the person that challenges God? What happens when there's a clash between major biblical theology and a major biblical hero? What happens? Well, that's what happens in the book of Job. Satan's a cynic. Satan doesn't believe that Job is truly good. Satan believes that the goodness of Job is not a reflection of the power of his character, but the quality of his circumstances. Job that quotes God, that's backed by God, is the greatest criticizer of God. How is it that the criticizer of God is supported by God? What is this book doing in the Bible? Religions are very different. Different theologies, different way of thinking, different approach to life, different understanding of God and humanity, but almost all great religions have some things in common. And the main thing they all have in common is that they make a very basic promise to its followers. It's the following promise: if you will follow our way, if you will follow God's words, good things will happen to you. Great things will happen to you. By the way, if you will violate God's words, if you will not walk in God's way, bad things will happen to you. Horrible things will happen to you. That is what religions promise their followers. Good things will happen to you if you will follow the path of religion. Now, this is a common motif, and here is another common motif. Religions never deliver. The promise of religion never becomes a reality. That gap between the world, the way it's supposed to look like, good things happening to good people, bad things happening to bad people, and the world, the way it actually is, that gap is religion not delivering, religion not fulfilling its promise. That gap is called the problem of theodicy. And it's a classic problem. It might be the most important problem that theologians have to deal with throughout the history of religion. You know what? Erase that. It is the most important problem. It's not probably the most important problem. It is the most important problem, the most central problem theologians have to deal with and have to deal with. And let's put it very simply, religion doesn't work. It doesn't happen. If you're not naive, if you look around, you realize the promise of religion, of all religion, is not fulfilled. That's the problem of theodicy. And that's the classic problem. And then there's the classic answer. But before I address the classic answer, I want to ask the problem of theodicy in a more analytical way. And this is how usually people, theologians, put it together. There's five assumptions that when you attach them together to each other, there's a contradiction. And here are the five problems. What I'm sharing with you now is just a different way to think about the problem of theodicy as a contradiction in terms. Here are five assumptions. One, God exists. Two, God is good. Three, God cares about the world and there's providence. God is watching out. He's guiding the world. He's controlling the world. He's governing the world in some way. Four, there are no limitations on God's power. He can do anything he wants. Kol yachol, omnipotent, no boundaries to his power. Five, bad things happen to good people. The world is not fair. You see, those five assumptions, when you put them together, there's a contradiction. Because it's impossible that God exists. He's good. He governs the world. There's no boundaries to his power. And yet, there's no justice in the world. And yet, bad things happen to good people. So how do we solve this problem, logically speaking? It's enough that you erase one assumption. You take one of these five assumptions and you throw it away and there's no contradiction. If God doesn't exist, no problem. There is no promise that was not fulfilled. There is no entity that delivered, that gave that promise. If God's not good, no contradiction. God's not good, so it's not surprising that bad things happen to good people. Maybe, like Aristotle thought, there's no providence. God's perfect, God's good. God doesn't govern the world. The world is on his own. Option number four, God exists, God's good, God governs the world. But God is not omnipotent. There are limitations on his power. He can't do whatever he wants. Now, any one of those, and then if you throw that assumption out, there's no contradiction. Bad things happen to good people because God is good and he cares, but he's limited. Now, throughout the history of theology, there were different attempts to throw away one of those four assumptions. Many atheists don't believe in God because of the problem of theodicy. Look, it doesn't work. Aristotle, as I mentioned, said there's no providence. Look, it doesn't really work. The Gnostics argued that God is not good. Or demiurgos, the creator of the world is not good. And once you realize, once you believe that the creator is not good, there is no problem, there is no contradiction with reality that bad things happen to good people. And finally, different other forms of dualism, the belief that the power of God is limited, it's limited by other forces of evil, and that's how you could explain that bad things happen to good people. So if you take one assumption, throw it out, no contradiction. But, and there were different trends in the history of philosophy and theology to throw away one of the first four. But the classical move, the most important move, the mainstream of monotheism, is to throw away assumption number five, is to say that the statement that bad things happen to good people, that the world is not fair, that's the part that's wrong. How can you do that? By saying that you might think, experience, feel that the world is not fair, that something very bad happened to someone very good. But you only think that and feel that and experience that because your perspective of reality is limited. If you'd have a large perspective, an infinite perspective, you would see that the world is fair. A few years ago, I was hiking with some friends of mine in Machtesh Ramon, a powerful crater in the Negev, down south. North is up in Israel, down south. And we were told there's this famous place in Machtesh Ramon in the crater where Golani soldiers take stones, they put them together, and they create words and sentences out of the stones. So we went to the place where the Golani Brigade always builds all these sentences with rocks, and we were looking around and we couldn't find it. We just saw random rocks. We didn't see any words. We didn't see any, no sentence, nothing. It was just rocks, and it was random. And we thought maybe we're not in the right place. Maybe what we were told, it's wrong, it's a rumor, Golani doesn't do that. But we couldn't find it. We continued walking. We were climbing this hill. And the top of the hill was actually like a mountain. On the top of the mountain, we look down and we see exactly where we were. A powerful sentence made out of gigantic stones. It said, Golani Chativa Mispar Achat. Golani, the number one brigade in the IDF. And we realized, wow, it was there and we couldn't see it. From up here, we see it. That's the idea. Sometimes, from short distance, things seem random. But from long distance, it seems like there's order. Order is revealed. From a narrow perspective, some things seem random. They seem meaningless. But from a broad perspective, it becomes meaningful. The classic argument in theology is to say, what you see that seems random, it's because you're watching, you're observing history and events from short distance. In the long run, it makes sense. It's not random, it's order. You have a narrow perspective. That's why it seems meaningless. But from a divine perspective, it's meaningful. So what we just did. The classic question, there's a contradiction between the five assumptions. And the classic solution is to deny the fifth assumption, The world is fair. And therefore, God exists. He's good. He guides the world. There's no limitations on his power. And the world is fair. It seems not fair because you're observing everything from short distance. It's like me and those rocks. It didn't make any sense. Me and my friends, it seemed random. But from the large perspective, everything has meaning. Everything is in its place. Be modest enough to know that your perspective is narrow, and therefore what you see is not really what you get, what the world gets. There is meaning. Bad things don't, the world is fair. Okay, so we asked, that's the question and the answer. Last week, I argued that the book of Job doesn't only ask the question, it also mocks the answer. How does it do it? Well, it asks the question through the story of Job, a good person that suffers. So through the story of Job, it asks the question. And then through God, in part three, remember, part one, the dialogue between God and Satan. Part two, the dialogue between Job and his friends. Part three, the dialogue between God and Job. So in part three, God appears to Job and he gives them the classic answer, the big picture answer. The answer that says, you feel like there's no justice, but what you see is narrow from my point of view, from the divine perspective. There is a reason for your suffering. It's meaningful. God gives him that answer. God says to him, Efo hayita biyosdi aretz? Where were you when I created the world that you could question the justice in this world? And Job, I'm quoting last week, I'm quoting myself, Job accepts God's answer. You have the divine perspective. There must be meaning. You're at the top of the hill. I'm just a guy in the rocks. I can't see anything. Job accepts God's answer, but the readers of Job can't accept God's answer because we know why Job is suffering. And the reason is not a cosmic mystery, big picture. It's because God made a bet with Satan. And when we know that, we listen to God's speech about the big picture, it sounds ridiculous. And so, which leads me to my conclusion that the book of Job doesn't only raise the question, it also creates a parody of the answer. So that was last week. And this is how I was challenged. My argument is that you read the end of Job in the light of the beginning of Job. And when you read the end of Job, the big mystery that God presents in front of Job, in light of the beginning of Job, of the bet, so the whole mystery monologue becomes ridiculous. And my argument, the book of Job makes a parody of the classic answer. But maybe we should reverse it. Instead of reading the end of Job in light of the beginning of Job, maybe we should read the beginning of Job in light of the end of Job. That is what I was asked. And then it means that the bet between God and Satan should be read in a larger perspective. Maybe that's the mystery. Maybe that's what we don't understand. Maybe that's very, very narrow thinking. Maybe there's a big picture here and we're misunderstanding the bet. And we're not misunderstanding God's monologue. Okay, that's a great challenge. I love this challenge. It makes a lot of hermeneutic sense. Where I read the end in light of the beginning, maybe we should read the beginning in light of the end. Maybe there is a big picture. Maybe there is a cosmic mystery. And the bet is just something we can't understand. Great. What I'd like to do now is to accept the challenge and offer a deeper, more detailed understanding of Job as a parody. So first, let's go back to part one. In part one of the book of Job, so if you remember, there's three words I want to take from part one. The first word is the word tam. Now, just to refresh your memory, the book of Job describes Job as tam. Ishtam, v'yashar, v'yare Elohim v'sar mera. And tam means whole, complete, perfect. And then there is a second appearance of the word tam. In chapter 2, it says that Job is tam, yashar, yare Elohim v'sar mera, ve'odenu machzik betumato. He is still tam, which means even after the catastrophe happened to him, even after he lost all his money, all his wealth, his 10 children, 7 boys, 3 girls, and became very sick with shechin, he lost his health, his wealth, and his children, he's still a mensch. He is still tam. Odeinu machzik betumato. That's one word I would like that makes 2 powerful appearances in the beginning, tam, which I would like for us to remember. Okay, I want to carry this word into part 2, into the dialogue. A second word is the word chinam. We did this work last week also. Satan says to God, chinam yare Iyov Elohim, chinam, for no real reason. You think for no reason Job is God-fearing and tam? Halo atzachta ba'ado ve'ba'ad beito. Remember what Satan challenges God. He says, Job is not really a good person. He just has great circumstances. His goodness is not expression of his spontaneous, of his soul. So he uses the word chinam to question Job. Maybe Job is not really good. In chapter 2, there is another appearance of the word chinam. The second appearance of the word chinam. And it appears like this. God says to Satan, Vatasiteni bo levol'o chinam. Powerful line we learned last week. That God says that Satan seduced him. Amazing. God was seduced by Satan. It's not a true story, but it's a real message. God says something here. Vatasiteni bo levol'o, to destroy him, to livloa, to swallow him, chinam. The second appearance of chinam flips the meaning of the story. The first chinam was, we were questioning whether Iyov was good. The second appearance of chinam, we're questioning whether God is good. If the first time we're saying, maybe Iyov is not good for nothing, chinam, the second appearance we're asking, maybe God is bad for nothing. He destroys Job's life for nothing. Chinam. So he had to prove something to Satan. Okay, so that's another word I want to carry with us. Chinam. And then a third word, which is so powerful, levul'o, to swallow, to destroy, the shoresh, bet lamed ein, levul'o. Okay, so levul'o. So these are 3 words, powerful words. Tam makes 2 powerful appearances. China makes 2 powerful appearances. And also levul'o makes 1, but we will see. It's an important word. Okay, so those are 3 words we are introduced, we meet in part 1. Now, I'm diving into part 2. The dialogue between Job and his friends. And Job tells his friends, listen, I am righteous. I didn't do anything wrong. This happened to me for no reason. Job's friends could not accept that. And it starts with Eliphaz. Eliphaz says to him, Ha'enosh me'eloa hitzdak, ime'osehu ita gaver. I'm quoting now from chapter 4. Eliphaz says to him, if you think nothing, you didn't do anything bad, that means you're better than God. How dare you say you are better than God? Because if you didn't do anything bad and bad things happen to you, that means God is bad, so therefore you are better than God. How dare you say that? Ha'enosh me'eloa itar. Itzdak, ha'enosh me'eloa itzdak. Can a human being be more righteous than God? Ha'im me'osehu itar gaver. Can a person be more pure than its creator? That's a rhetorical question that Eliphaz directs at Job. In chapter 5 and 6, Job answers him. And then another friend, Bildad, there are 3 friends, right? Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So the second, and later on, Elihu. So the second friend, Bildad, joins in, and he amplifies the criticism. He's even more harsh than Eliphaz. He says to him, Ha'el ye'avet bishpat, ve'im shaddai ye'avet tzedek. Do you really think God is distorting his judgment? That's what you think? And it goes on and on in chapter 8, and then it reaches a peak. In chapter 8, verse 20, he says to him, Bildad yells at Job, and he says to him,
הן אל לא ימאס תם, ולא יחזיק ביד מרעים. Bildad says to Job, God never neglects tam, righteous people. Therefore, if he neglected you, you're not righteous. Hen el lo yimas tam. God never does that. Now, something as interesting is happening to the sensitive readers. We hear Bildad protecting God, saying to Job, God never neglects a tam, a whole person. But there's something we know that Bildad doesn't know, that God did do that. And the entity that said that God did that was God himself. Odeinu machzik betumato, that's God saying to Satan, Job is still a tam, vatasiteni bo levolo chinam. So God tells us that he destroyed the life of a tam, and Bildad, being such a tzaddik, such a from person, protecting God, saying, Hen el lo im astam. God never does anything wrong to a person that is tam. That is the third appearance of the word tam, which takes me to the fourth appearance of the word tam. In chapter 9, Job now answers Bildad, and he says a lot of things to him, but one of the things he says is the following. Im etzdak piyal shieni tam ani vayakshini. Job says, I am a tam, tam ani. And then in verse 21, which is one of the most, I think, powerful verses in the book of Job, one of them, he says to him, not the most powerful, we won't have time. Next week we'll see the most powerful verse in the book. I think the most powerful verse in the book of Job. He says to him, tam ani lo eida nafshi imas chayai. Let's read it again. Tam ani, Job says, tam ani lo eida nafshi imas chayai. Let me translate this. I am tam. I am righteous. I am whole. You think I don't know myself? Lo eida nafshi. I don't want to live anymore. This is what Job is saying. God took everything away from me. My children, my health, my wealth, he took everything. But there's one thing you're not going to take away from me. My self-esteem. I know myself. My self-image, you're trying to crack that. That's the only thing I have left. I still believe in myself. That's the last thing, and that's what you can't take away from me. Tam ani lo eda nafshi. Now us, the readers of Job, we know something. We know that Job is yelling. We know who agrees with Job. God agrees with Job. This is the fourth appearance of the word tam. It starts with God before the catastrophe. He says he's a tam. Then God says it to him after the catastrophe. And then Bildad says, God never does this to people that are tam. And then the fourth appearance, Job says, I am tam, I know myself. And there's something the readers of Job know about Job that Job doesn't know. What Job says about himself, God says about Job. Let's see the word chinam, chinam. So in verse 17, chapter 9, verse 17, we're running out of time. God says, Job says, Asher b'sha'ara yeshufeini v'hirba p'tza'ai chinam. He complains. He shouts to his friend, and he said that God filled him with bruises, chinam. Now there's something that his friends don't know. That Job is not the only person that says that everything that happened to him is for chinam. God said that in the beginning of the book. Job doesn't know this. He's quoting God. And finally, the word levol'o. So we saw how the third appearance of chinam. Now the word levol'o is so sad. In chapter 10, verse 8, Job says this. Yadecha itzvuni v'ya'asuni yachad saviv vativ la'eni. He says to God, you created me and now you destroyed me. Yadecha itzvuni v'yasuni. You created me, and now you are destroying me. And the word he uses to describe how God is crushing his own creation is vativla'eini. Again, the sensitive readers of Job are now aware of something very powerful that's happening that Job doesn't know. I wanted to, what is it that Job doesn't know? So I wanted to try to put this together. So what's happening here? What's happening is that Bildad, Eliphaz, they are protecting God. And they're saying, you must have done something wrong. God never does anything wrong. Hen Elohim astam. They're protecting God. Job is quoting God. This is the irony here. They are protecting God. He, without knowing it, is quoting God. Tam ani lo eda nafshi. Hirba ptza'ai chinam. Yadecha asuni v'yetzvuni. Yadecha saviv v'tivla'ein. Yachad saviv tivla'eini. This is the drama here. They are protecting God. He is quoting God. Which takes me to another textual drama that's happening here. God is not the only person being quoted subconsciously or without them knowing. Also, the Bible is being quoted. I want to show something very interesting that Ed Greenstein saw in his introduction, his great introduction to the to his translation of Job. And this is, I don't have a lot of time, I'll do this very briefly. In the book of Mishle, and you're invited if you want to open Proverbs chapter 13. So, Proverbs chapter 13, verse 9, we get the classic narrative. O reshaim yismach, v'ner reshaim idach. The light of the righteous people will be radiant and will grow, and the light of evil people will be extinguished. Ner reshaim idach. That's a metaphorical way through light to say bad things will happen to bad people, good things will happen to good people, the world is fair. O reshaim yismach, ner reshaim idach. Remember those three words, ner reshaim idach. That's the way of Proverbs to echo the classic biblical motif, bad things happen to bad people. Ner reshaim idach. Now, Bildad, in Job chapter 18, says to Job, you don't understand the world, there's a big picture, and so forth and so on, and he tells him in chapter 18, verse 5, Gam or reshaim idach. He's almost literally quoting Proverbs. Or reshaim idach. Bad things get, you know, they get punished in the end. The world is fair, there is justice. Just wait a while. Or reshaim idach. So the wisdom of Proverbs is now quoted or channeled through Bildad, through one of Job's friends. But then, in Job 21, this is the chapter where Job is very, very upset. And he says there's no justice in the world. And then it reaches a peak when Job yells and he says, Kama ner reshaim idach. V'yavo eleimu idam chavalim yichalek be'apo. Kama nereshaim idach. How often is it that bad people are punished in this world? How often? Like in the real life, empirically. Kama nereshaim idach. So Proverbs says, nereshaim idach. And Bildad says, o reshaim idach. And Job comes out and says, Kama nereshaim idach. How often does it happen? It barely happens. The gap between Proverbs and Bildad and Job is the gap between the promise and reality. In the world the way it's supposed to be, nereshaim idach. The light of the evil is extinguished. But in real life, Job asks sarcastically, how often does that happen? There is a gap between the world the way it is and the world the way it actually is. the way it should be and the way it actually is. But that gap is now played out between Proverbs, Bildad, and Job, which means Job undermines Proverbs. The book of Job himself criticizes Bildad that quotes Proverbs. So let's try to conceptualize our situation. His friends protect God. Job quotes God. His friends, Bildad, quote the Bible. Job criticizes the Bible. It doesn't work. Kama ner resha'im idach. Who's right? Who's right? The person who quotes God or the person who protects God? The person who quotes the Bible or Job that's criticizing the Bible? Who's right? Now, surprisingly, there is actually an answer to this question. The book of Job offers an answer to this question. It's the following answer. Towards the end of the book of Job, Job 42, there is a shocking, shocking moment. Towards the end of the book, when the plane is starting to land, when the drama is almost over, after God told Job, there is the big picture, Ephoita bios diaretz, God takes a turn, and this is what he says. Chapter 42, verse 7. V'yachar diber Adonai et advarim ha'ele el Iyov, after his monologues with Iyov, to Iyov. V'yomer Adonai el Eliphaz, God says to Eliphaz, one of the three friends, the more dominant one. We're quoting today mainly Bildad, but Eliphaz is actually the one with more words, the more dominant one. Hateimani, chara pi becha uvishne re'echa. I am angry at you. I have rage directed at you. Chara pi is a metaphor. In the Bible, when it says chara pi, usually people die afterwards when God has rage. Chara pi. Why is God so angry at Bildad, at Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar? Why so angry? Ki lo dibartem elai nechona ke'avdi Iyov. This is a verse we're going to unpack next session. But for now, let's notice something. I am angry at you because you didn't speak. Nechona doesn't, in modern Hebrew, means properly. But in biblical Hebrew, it means authentically, correctly. Nachon, milshon kenut. You didn't speak the truth like Job did. Now this is crazy. On the verge of unbelievable. The entire book, Job criticizes God. Eliphaz protects God. God comes out and he's angry at Eliphaz that he didn't speak the truth like Job did. It turns out that God is on the side of Job, not his friends. God is on the side of the person that criticizes Proverbs, not the person who quotes Proverbs. God is on the side. Maybe it's simple to understand this. The person that's quoting God, not the ones who are protecting God, which takes this session to a beginning of a conclusion. We start with the question, how should we read Job? Should we read the end of Job in light of the beginning of Job and then it's a parody? Or the beginning of Job in light of the end of Job, then it's a more mainstream, from the way, you know, it's supposed to look like. But maybe there's another move. Let's read Job himself, the figure, the character Job, in light of the beginning and the light of the end. It turns out, if we read the beginning of Job and then listen to Job, we realize he is quoting God. And we read the end of the book of Job, God turning to Eliphaz and saying, Lo dibartem elai nechona ke avdi Iyov. We realize he is backed by God. He is supported by God. Job quotes God. That's from the beginning of the book. Job is supported by God. That's the end of the book. Which takes me to the extreme conclusion. Actually, this is the end of session 3, which leads us maybe, takes the paradox of Job to a very extreme place. This is probably the most extreme version of the paradox of the book of Job. Job that quotes God, that's backed by God, is the greatest criticizer of God. I'll say that again. Job that's the greatest criticizer of God is also the only one that's quoting God and he's supported by God. How is it that the criticizer of God is supported by God and without knowing is constantly quoting God? How does that work out? Well, that's what comes out when you read Job in light of the beginning and the end. You listen to Job's arguments in light of the beginning and the end, and we reach the paradox. Job that criticizes God is also quoting God and supported by God. That paradox is a paradox I want to start unpacking next session. Using some ideas of Rabbi Jonathan Zaks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, I want to start making biblical sense out of this biblical paradox. But for now, I'm leaving you all with this crazy biblical paradox. You have to give up a lot. You can't eat what you want to eat. If it's Shabbat, you can't go where you want to go. You can't use what you want to use. It's limitations on your behavior. Here's the question. Is being religious also mean limitations on your thinking? Limitations on your speaking? The book of Job answers that. The book of Job says it's the other way around.